Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah, I think so. So, welcome everybody to our brief talk about medical data, data access, research, and open science. I'm glad that at least some of you are here. So, maybe a brief introduction for us. So, this is Bastian.
Hey.
And I'm Fabian. We both were working with the OpenSNP project, which deals with publishing genotyping data, genetic information for open access research. And I'm a evolutionary biology messing around with a little bit of computational biology, most of the time with stuff that I don't really understand, which is not very reassuring, but at least this topic is rather fun. So the bottom line is power to the patient. And as a brief outline, we are going to introduce you to the basically traditional way of how data was handled in medicine. And you can see already there's for quite a long time biology and medicine wasn't really distinguishable. You started off with measuring very basic parameters of your body and then writing them down and monitoring them for a long time and then trying to mess with this data. And with the advancement of technology, more sources were basically added to the mix. X-rays, for example, something that is still used today, rather old, over 100 years. And then the techniques got a little bit more advanced. So the next steps were basically to plug all together with computers, for example, with X-rays in the early 1970s, and then develop more advanced technologies like MRI imaging. So what we now do, which is rather exciting, at least for us biologists, it was super expensive like 20 years ago to get genetic data from humans, like a multi-billion dollar project to sequence the first genome. But now, in 2011, it's actually not very expensive anymore, which is super awesome if you think about it, because at the moment it's maybe a couple of 10,000 euros and getting less and less to sequence your whole genome. So your complete genetic data. And if you look at this, you can see already what that means. People are talking about it. This thing on the left there, it has a USB device and it's like a micro sequencer. So you can just add some genetic material and it'll do its work, and then you plug it into your computer and you'll have basically a flat file that contains all your genetic data, which is pretty amazing. And if you just scale this for maybe 2 or 3 years, this will be possible. So we are sitting on a lot of data, and the one guy on Twitter basically stated that what cell phones can do now and today, at one point they could just sequence people's DNA and just walking by. So there's a lot of stuff that could happen with this, and it's rather exciting because no one really knows what the direction this is taking. But what's happening right now, and what we are working with, is, for example, the data from 23andMe. I don't know if anyone is familiar with that service. But no, one guy, and you are you actually genotyped already, or
no, just heard of them.
Yeah. So it's pretty cool. So Bastian, for example, genotyped himself, and all the information is available online. And Samantha, I think you did that too. So you can basically sequence 1 billion positions, variable positions in your DNA, and these positions are associated with a certain disease risk, for example, or a certain phenotype. And this is possible now. It costs around $200, so it's not really expensive anymore. And this is data that is generated outside the research community. So you don't need to go to a scientific research lab and go through all these hoops, but you can just buy it on the free market. So there's a lot of data being generated right now, and the logical next step would be to make this a service not only for a small share of your genome, like 1 million positions, but for example, sequence all the parts that are actually active and protein coding. For example, your exome, which is also now possible. And beside the genetic information, which is already exciting, what's happening is people are using this quantified self movement. So they start tracking information about their cells, like their health information, their sleep cycles, and how many steps they take, exercises. And all this data is just sitting there. And you can easily see that once you start connecting this information, you might add some value, and some research findings are rather interesting. And now the most generic slide that I could come up with It's basically true. If you look at the available technology right now, it doesn't really matter anymore, right? Time is going on, technology is advancing, and we're just generating a shitload of data. It's there. I mean, I'm working with it every day. It's not the problem of actually generating data or looking at it. It's just it's sitting there, and no one really knows how to analyze it. So there's a total lack of knowledge what to do with it, and that's advancing. But the amount of data is really there. And this data is not organized very well, it's spread. And so the question that we're posing is actually, are we in the brave new data world? Is data the only thing that we really need to make this world a better place? Because it's there, it's sitting there, and we need to figure out what to do with it. And one of the first questions that comes up is this thing here. Whose data is this actually? So if you sequence your genetic material, is that your data? Do you own that data? Is that your specific information that you can claim? And if you look at the left, for the people that don't speak German, so Novartis is an international pharma company, and there was a brief article about them trying to access patient data from doctors for whatever purpose. And the funny story is that we actually had a talk at Novartis a couple of weeks ago because they approached us with genetic data and were rather interested. So obviously there is some interest from these companies in this data, because if it means that in this data there is some sort of knowledge and some sort of information that they can use to make money with, then they'll use it. So there is a strong interest in that case. And on the other side you can see that it's not, especially if you're talking about genetic information, I think most of you are aware of that, that if you sequence yourself, this is not just information that is from you, but also from your parents or from your siblings. So doing that and sharing it also means that you share information about your family. So there's actually no real model how to account for that. Because if you have a bad stand with your parents, you don't talk to them, then you start on publishing something that they might not want. So this is quite interesting. And this just shows you, I think it didn't, so most of the people, at least in Germany, are not aware of that right now. But this is happening, and people can access directly customer genetic testing that provides them with results about their health records. Like, for example, their risk for obesity or their risk for specific types of cancer that are genetically associated. And there's no doctor involved. So you just order this genetic test from the company, you get it at home, delivered by mail, and at some point on some online platform, they chose to show you the results. It's very nicely done. And what you end up with is a report of your specific risks. So you don't need, or supposedly don't need, any professional counseling for that. So there's a whole market developing with medical data or biological data that doesn't depend on classical doctor-patient relationships anymore, which is rather interesting. And then, one story, I think, when was it patented? From Visa?
Last year.
So Visa, for example, the credit company, they filed a patent last year on genetic advertising. So this is, a very obvious use case. If you have the genetic data of a person and you want to create ads, then this is information that is highly relevant to you. Because if someone has diabetes and requires medication and you know that, then you can just add diabetes ads, which is for them awesome and generates lots of profit. And on the other side, law enforcement, for example, could use this genetic data and actually already has access to this data right now, because all these companies are situated in a specific country. And I don't know, if the FBI knocks on your door to 23andMe and says, we need this specific profile, I'm pretty sure they will not deny that. And it's also stated, because what should they do? So there is access to this data, and the question is, if this access is there, what do we do? And the first thing that comes to mind, and I think that's happening or at least established right now in a little bit, is the access to this specific type of data is rather closed. There is, for example, a health record at your doctor's, and if you switch your doctor, then he might know what was going on beforehand, and you can't really access it. It's basically just sitting somewhere and not easily accessible. And what that leads to is, and I had that already this week, and it was wonderful. I went to the dentist, and because I had to get a root canal treatment, which was rather painful, And I was there on Thursday, which was a holiday, so I couldn't go to my normal doctor, but I had to go to some emergency thing. And they asked me about my x-rays and about my patient history, and I couldn't provide it. I was just like, yeah, I don't know what this guy did beforehand. And yeah, then I said, I can't see anything, so we need to do an x-ray again. So I ended up with being x-rayed because the access to the data of the doctor beforehand wasn't given, which in that specific moment, you don't really have a choice, right? I just wanted the tooth to stop hurting, and then you just say, okay, yeah, x-ray me, I'm fine, right? But this is maybe something that needs to be improved. And also, if you just think about it, basic time step analysis. If you want to know if your wisdom teeth needs to be pulled, you might want to know if it grows. And you can see that in your 3 x-ray pictures that you took in the last 5 years. Right? And this information is completely hidden. You can't use it for yourself. And I think that's rather sad. So it might lead to double examinations and to stuff that just costs money and is actually maybe unhealthy. So, and this is something that we think is rather bad, because we are forced into, as patients, into a very passive role. You don't have any active decision-making involved about what this genetic data or your medical data, what is happening with it, right? You can try to access it. It's actually possible by law, but it might be rather bitchy because it generates some kind of bureaucratic act, and it's not that easy. Yeah, so. And on the other side, I mean, there is some sort of experience with your treatment, right? If you actually would track, for example, how a specific medication helps you or doesn't help you, it might help a doctor to decide if you want to continue that treatment. But if there is no place where you can look that up, then you're screwed, and maybe you'll get just the same treatment all over again. So, and on the other side, patient groups are a super cool way to gather information about, for example, a disease. If you don't know how something is working and you have people talking about it who are all affected by it, then you can just gather more knowledge from it. So this is also not used. So this leaves you basically in between the extremes, right? You have some sort of closed access, which doesn't make you very happy. And on the other side, you have some sort of open access, which is also not good if it ends in some sort of centralized database. So what do we do?
Okay, so our idea on this is what the talk title says, basically let the patient decide what to do. And there's this concept around, which we just will present as the personal health record, where you will store your lab results, which are made of blood or whatever you were tested, and your family history, your medical imaging results like the x-rays, MRIs, CT scans like this, data about your allergies, which might be interesting. So if you're allergic to some kind of antibiotics, then you might not want to get this shot from it. And so, and also genetic information can be stored on this, and similarly self-reported results. So if I start to do some quantified self and track all my eating habits, my habits on workout, stuff like this, this might also be some of interest for doctors for my further medication, for example. And so the big benefit of personal health records is that the patient should decide whom to share the data with. So there's a difference to the electronic health records, which you might know, and those are not used basically for patients. They are used for the communication between doctors and their insurance companies of the patients. So you don't have any control as a patient what will get done with the data. The doctors store the data on their computers and communicate with the health insurance companies. And you don't have any option what to do with it. And at least from the doctors I've visited, most of the data isn't that super secure in any way. So this is a problem as well. So what the personal health records could offer is a permission system for the data. So for example, if I go to a new general practitioner for everyday sicknesses, I maybe don't want him to know about my STDs or my psychiatric diseases, which don't really have to benefit him. And you also could provide some APIs to connect those electronic health records, which already exist, to your own personal health record to grab the data and have it available for you too. So if the doctor or Fabian does some x-rays, he automatically gets the data in his account as well. And you could also allow patients to add data to it, like those glucose meters. So if you have diabetes, then you might check your glucose levels every day, and you upload it, and your doctor will also see if you're on a good track or not and what you could do to improve your health. So the benefits of sharing are, you personally retain control of who gets access to what. you can share with your doctor much better the information which might improve your medication, diagnosis, and anamnesis, so you don't have to, as Fabian was asked, so what was your history on those teeth, so, which you might not really that know, but if your doctor can provide it easily from your database, it might be a cool way. And we are both scientists, so we like sharing data to a limited extent because it might be useful for us. Oh yeah. So it would be great if people also would be willing to share data for science. And this concept is not really new, but we still have a long way to go. So as Craig from the US stated, my doc has an online personal health record directly populated by her provider's electronic health record. The rest of the family does not. So our pets actually are already better improved or have better access to the data than we do. And on the right hand, you see one of the German companies which try to provide such a great service. You see the wonderfully designed website, which looks like 1990 about. And what you actually can see here, or should be able to read, was this was created in 2007. And since then, so it's 2012, they have about 350 visitors on their website. So personal health records are a great hit here in Germany, or maybe not that much. And yeah. Maybe there are some companies in Germany which do better, but I couldn't find any on the web, so they may be hidden. So, of course, there are also problems with personal health records, which we have to stress here. First of all, as a patient, if you have the power to decide which data your doctor might want to see, you have to decide on some basic level which data might interest my doctor. So otherwise, you will just give all the data away and you have not improved your privacy or the access to the data in any way. And then, yeah, the question is, do I really want to keep track of this data for myself and have to think about it? So right now, it might suck if you have to get another X-ray of your teeth, but you don't have to think about storing the data somewhere, and you basically don't have to worry about managing the data at all. So, and there are also practical issues, of course. So where do I want to store the data? If there's, again, one central storage database, then you are not better off than previously where the data was centralized for your health insurance company, so this might be not the best option. And on the other hand, most people maybe don't want to set up their own open software, open source personal health record on their own server because they might not be able to do so, which you also get to keep in mind. And then the biggest question is, who will be liable in case of data loss, security breaches? So if I upload my data to some Google health record, which was, they had the service, but they closed it again, so it's just like Google Wave. So yeah, but if Google gets hacked or the data gets lost and there's no backup, yeah, who's in charge for this? But there are already some similar examples which we'd like also to present, is where similar devices are already used in the research setting, in the clinical settings, and in patient groups or for self-help. So first of all, research, as scientists, we like this the best. So OpenSNP, as Fabian told, is our project, and people can upload their 23andMe data and can publish also their phenotype traits, so which diseases do they have, which hair color, which eye color, all the stuff which might have some genetic roots. And it's completely open source. The data is completely open. It's licensed under Creative Commons Zero, so basically all the data goes into the public domain. And this is the extreme case of openness, which Fabian talked about beforehand. So you might not want to do it if you're not sure you can handle the possible bad results. So it's a personal choice which you'll have to make. Then similarly, there's Genomera. This is a startup of San Francisco, and they collect, yeah, basically they do crowdsource studies. So all the users can go together on their website and say, hey, I would like to do a study on disease X, and let's think about a study design. They collaboratively design the study, think about which genetic data they need, and then people can join those studies, which are also openly available, and hopefully you find out some cool things. And the Personal Genome Project is the idea which inspired us to do OpenSNP. This is basically only for US citizens right now, and they also collect all the health records they can get from their participants and want to sequence the complete genomes. But they have the big problem that it's still quite expensive, so it doesn't really take off right now. So they have, I think, 200, 300 data sets about this. So yeah, it's also not that great already. But there are also other examples which don't involve genetic information, and this is patients like me. So where people sign up, it's the a bit like Facebook for health data. People sign up, state which diseases they have, and then they find friends who have similar diseases and talk about what they did, which medication helped them, which not, stuff like this. And this is actually useful for research as well. So on the lower right side, you see a publication which was done, I think, in, it should state there, 2011. So they, beforehand, there was a study about amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. So it's a degenerative disease, which you can't stop right now, but you can try to slow it down. And some Italian researchers did a study on this with a really low sample size and found out that if you regularly take lithium carbonate, you can slow the progress of the disease. And all the users which ALS have on patients like me said, hey, let's do a study on this and collect the data. Some just went to the pharmacy and got themselves some lithium carbonate, took it, and then they compared, did it slow down my progress of the disease compared to the group who didn't take it? And they found out actually, no, this unfortunately doesn't help. But it was only possible because it's crowdsourced and the people just signed up and tried it, so, which would have been really, really expensive and took years if you had done it in a clinical setting. And there are other uses for this data in the clinical setting as well. So on the left side, we see the Wunderlich project. So Karl Wunderlich is the guy who measured our human temperature, our body temperature, in the, 1800s, someone. And he did this by just taking the temperatures of lots and lots of people and established which temperature is the normal temperature for human beings. And this is fine, and it hasn't really much defined or wasn't improved since then. But you might be interested as a doctor. So if I did some operation on my patient and it's 2 days after the operation, should my patient still have a higher temperature than normal? And if so, how high should it be? And so what these guys do at this hospital, they took the data of all their patients which had a certain operation and measured the temperature. And now they have this crowdsourced website, basically, without people knowing that they are part of the crowdsourcing, which is the problem. But you can just type in which kind of operation you have performed, how many days the operation was done ago, and some other factors, and then you will see how good your patient performs on the level of body temperature, which wasn't possible beforehand. And the same hospital did this study on antibiotics-resistant bacteria, which are really, really bad and can actually kill people in the hospital, because if they are already sick and then get an infection which you can't get rid of with antibiotics, it might be really, really bad for your patient. So what they did is they did collect the data of, again, all patients in their hospital and looked for patterns which patients will have an infection with such resistant bacteria. And they did a really great predictive model. So they found out which patients are most likely to get or already have an infection with those, and can then just shove them away in quarantine already, so you don't have to worry about it that much. So isolation for you, the rest is fine, we'll get not sick hopefully. So this is really cool. And again, this is done on the electronic health record, so the patients didn't really have any say in participating in it, which is sad. And there's another example of self-help, which is done with the quantified self movement. And this is Dan Horn. He works at Nike, and maybe you've heard of the Nike Fuel Band, which is similar to the Fitbit. So it collects data about how active you are. But he used to be a bit, he was not that normal weight, so his body mass index was a bit too high, and his doctor diagnosed him with type 2 diabetes, partially because of his overweight. So what he did, he started to track all his activities, how much he ate, how much he moved, and he lost weight in a great deal. And basically he did so because his doctor said, well, if you basically already have type 2 diabetes and we can't stop it, and you will now have to take insulin shots regularly. And he said, no way, I really don't want to get those insulin shots, because giving me this stuff regularly, I don't really like to, I don't like needles. So his outcome was, data saved my life. Well, it's a bit oversimplified because he would have made it probably even with type 2 diabetes and insulin shots. But up to date, he don't has to take those shots and gets up fine. And what he also says is this siloed data, that if you have the data somewhere stored where you can't access it, might actually lead to people dying, because the data would have been there and you could have seen that the person is sick and would have needed help. But he couldn't do anything about it because the data was stored in some corporate repositories. So what basically is our, yeah, our summary is what Misha Engrist said. He's an author and biological genetic data counselor. If biomedical science remains an us and them proposition, it bodes neither for us, neither for us nor for them. So it hurts research. It hurts the patients if we stay this. Yeah, the patient doesn't need to know anything. He don't need access to data. And yeah, this is really bad. So I think we all can benefit from a change if we can make data more accessible and give patients the option to collect data and have access to the data themselves. And we should now start to think about how we could improve or how we could implement such stuff, because otherwise it might be too late and then we'll have just the electronic health records which are used for communicating with the health insurance companies and you have no say in it at all. So if you have any good ideas, please let us know. And so far, thanks for listening, and now we can do some discussion.
Yeah. And don't eat too much bacon. It's really not that healthy.
Oh, that you tell me now. Yeah, I wanted to say that I think most of the research, especially standardization, is unfortunately done in the US, so, and maybe not unfortunately, it would be good if more German people would participate there, because I was once active in the Cantara Initiative's User Managed Access Group, which is about this sharing problem, how you give access. I have my data, how I give access to some other party under maybe certain conditions and things like that. So that might be something which might be of interest here. So it's Cantara Initiative. There is especially also one use case for this done by Gerhard Beuchelt, who was is working on age data, which is a format for specifying these health records. And he also has a use case for using user managed access, which is a protocol then to actually access the data. So there's some stuff going on. So that might be a starting point at least.
Yeah, I think one thing that also happens and that is forgotten sometimes is that huge studies with a lot of participants that are made available to the public typically have a certain amount of downstream effects. So there are results that are completely unanticipated when the study was carried out, but because it is open and other people can work with the data, they dig out some really awesome results. And this is something that I personally think would be really amazing if you would have an active movement of patients interested in that you could use this data and that probably you could harvest these downstream effects at some point just by making it more open and accessible to the research community. But that's, I think, more like a personal statement because I have to work with it and I would love to do more.
Yeah, but those downstream effects, also the problem is right now it's not almost never specified what to do with incidental findings. Yeah. So if I collect your genetic information for disease X and find out that you also have disease Y and we haven't talked about beforehand, so should I tell you or shouldn't I not tell you? So I really don't know, and people have the right not to know the results. So basically the only thing you can do is just hide the information from the patient or just ask him, so if I hypothetically found out that you might have disease Y, so should I tell you about this? Which might, not be the optimal solution for this as well.
Plus some patients may just choose to be anonymous or non-traceable. So actually, if it comes out that they have a certain disease, then they are screwed, which is their right, but maybe not the best thing.
My question is, I have a couple of them. First of all, is this based on the assumption that the patient will be competent enough in making decisions about who he can trust the data with? Because, for example, the older generation, I don't see my grandmother being able to decide which portion of the her medical history she can share with her doctor. That is one thing. And what is the potential abuse, malicious abuse of personal medical records that you can foresee?
So the first thing is, I think this problem is still not really solved. Because I talked with some people dealing with bioethics, I think a couple of weeks ago. And the main problem there from an ethical standpoint is that actually, you're never competent enough to make this decision because you have absolutely no idea of the outcome, right? If some scientist says, yeah, I'll use this data for whatever, then yeah, something can just happen to with your data that you didn't anticipate. And then if this effect sets in, then if you would have known that beforehand, you wouldn't have given your consents, right? So it's very difficult to actually measure that. And so it is tackled, for example, by, is it a startup or EU-funded, the We Consent Us project?
So I'll just go on. So there's this project, We Consent Us, from John Wilbanks, who was the head of Creative Commons Science before. And he tries to implement a portable consent process so that you can say, I publish my data, and there's some ethics board involved before you do so. So you have to take some tests and read all the documents, and if you can't pass the multiple choice test, you have proven that you don't have an idea what happens with your data. So there's at least a simple way to do it, and it's a bit better regulated than right now, which is nothing at all.
As goes for the where to store the data, as far as I know, pets right now have implanted RFID chips that contain some data of their medical history and so on. The question is, in case, let's take a long shot at this and say we implant everyone with an RFID chip that contains their medical history and such. What is the potential for a security breach of that? Because as far as I know, I can take a reader with me. You have a chip implanted in your arm. I could stand right next to you and steal the data. What can I do with this data? And is this a better solution than having a centralized data bank?
So for now, pets don't have their information stored, just a unique identifier which goes back to the database. So you just would get the unique ID of your pet if you scan it, so you might have to hack the database first. So it's not that easy as you think, but I think and storing all the data on RFID tags might not that be easy. If you want to store your whole genome, it's 1.4 gigabytes of data. So it might take a bit sitting around waiting for the transfer to be ready. So yeah, I think that you won't be, in the near future at least, you won't have an implant which all the data contains on your body or in your body.
Oh, so we still require a centralized data bank for storing the medical records. So what? I assume that there is no point to that then, holding the RFID.
Yeah, or you could try to do it decentralized. So like Diaspora tried for social networks and isn't ready yet, but you could think about our peer-to-peer solutions. But we are still that early in the development that we don't have any really solution for this problem.
But just for the risk association with this specific data, I mean the potential risk, this RFID technology in our ID cards in Germany, for example, has been shown to be, abusable, or your profiles from your mobile cell phone provider could track your movement, all this stuff. I mean, there's a huge potential of money and abuse because, look at the Visa pattern, right? They filed it for genetic advertising. Obviously, there is some sort of interest in this data. And if Novartis, an international company, tries to get access to health records from patients, they will not do that for, developing the solution for cancer just for free, right? There is a certain interest. And it is abusable, that's for sure.
I just wanted to add a remark on what was just previously said on the grandmother case for deciding who to trust with the data. Just to answer your particular answer, I think it's much more a matter of trust than on a rational decision. Right? Of course, you never know the outcome of things, but at least it's a trust process. But even then, I'm extremely pessimistic about this choice. It's not about even a grandmother. It's about any one of us on the hospital bed, torn with physical pain, and asked by a physician or a doctor or whoever in front of you, asking you, look, I need the whole of the data, not just some access. Give me the whole password for the whole data. And off I go, certainly. I mean, it's the same kind of decision, very far-reaching decision that we make when we sign up for Facebook or buy an iPhone. So I certainly don't see anyone having the strength and I think, wisdom and consider time for consideration to answer that question in a very wise way.
Shall I?
Well, I think we have to differ between maybe the scientific use case and maybe the dentist use case in this case. Or maybe dentist is not so drastic. Let's say I'm about to die. Maybe that's a different thing then. Because there was a good podcast episode on This Week in Law with Doc Searls, if you Google that. That was very interesting because he lost his mother, I think, because of missing data. And he, of course, has a strong case there why data sharing in this case is, might save your life. And this may be different from Facebook. So I would, you always have to see the balance here. Of course, you can also regulate things. When if Visa does these things, you can regulate this. So you can,
yeah.
I mean, the whole insurance industry is regulated to some extent. What they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. So you can do that. Depends on maybe on the fines, what you said there. Then another thing about the decentralized approach, there is the personal data ecosystem, also a work group or some Verein or something, who are also working on these things where it's more decentralized and where they're working more on the contract thing, how you license your data or something like this, not so much on the technical thing, I think. So they bring this, or try to bring this together, so that you maybe also exchange data for some benefits or something.
And maybe some comment also that I tried to, or the point that I wanted to make in the beginning with a growing amount of data, as for example Facebook shows every day, or Google Plus, or whatever, the data is available, so, or will be even more available in the very close future, so there is the option to generate just a lot of medical data, for example your genome, where we are not really sure yet what is actually in there. I mean, we have a pretty good idea for some things, but for some others we really don't. So this data will be available, and then the question is, how do we handle it? And I think it's, at least for me personally, and I think this is also why Bastian and I find this topic so interesting, that we have to find a system that handles the data in an acceptable way, because otherwise I'm pretty sure it won't, right? Because there are so many interests, and especially because people that are aware of how data can be accessed and how easy it sometimes is to break into a centralized system, I think it's also maybe, well, maybe not our responsibility, but we might have a certain say on how this, or in which direction this could go. So I think it's super important to develop ideas and to work in that field. That's at least my opinion.
Okay, so I wanted to ask about a question about the competence that was raised earlier. So if I'm not competent enough because I didn't study medicine or biology and whatsoever, and I start to collect data about myself, like quantified self movement, and I decide to, well, I've collected so much data about myself, like in the diabetes type 2 case, that I decide to, well, my doctor, he doesn't know anything, because I have collected so much data about me, and I decide to, well, ignore my physician and go do something he isn't recommending. That might work, and in this case it did, but that's a very bad justification for this result. This I would argue that's purely by chance, because if you're, by definition, if you don't know about anything about medical data or anything about the data you've been collecting for a quantified self, then you can't interpret the data right. Whereas a physician that did study medicine, he can tell something more about the data. How much of a problem is that?
I'd like, just for the diabetes guy who did this, he went to the physician and he had the lab values on how much of his blood sugar raised and dropped again, so he just didn't do it alone, but in contact, and in cooperation with his physician. So he just collected much more data than a normal patient would do, and so then got back to his physician. But yeah, the general problem about the competence will stay always. I mean, it's just like if you now have a headache and go to Wikipedia, 2 minutes later you think you have brain cancer. Yeah, so I think this problem won't go away in the near future. So I don't know how one could really solve it, because the if you collect all the data and take actions on your own, you could have done so before we collected any data and just don't visit your physician or stuff like this. So I don't know. Yeah, I don't see a solution for this problem in general.
Yeah, and for example, what's happening with the 23andMe results, so for genetic testing, they specify, for example, an increased risk for cancer or obesity, which is like 700% increased risk to the rest of the population. And well, if the risk for getting this cancer in the first place is very, very low, then 700% more is actually not that much. But this specific step, like basic probabilities, is already pretty difficult. I mean, it's difficult for me for certain. And I think you are right in a way stating that people have difficulties interpreting that, and that doctors are there for a reason. But if I hand like my 23andMe file to my doctor in Münster, he'd look at me in horror and I don't know, probably has absolutely no idea what's going on. And even if I don't have any idea, yeah, we sit on that data, and obviously that's a problem. So maybe on the long run, there also need to be a mechanism or a change in how we treat this data, right? It's not only, especially with the genetic data, it's pretty obvious that a doctor who does that for 40 years has no idea about what's going on. But for example, for diabetes, he has. And as Stefan, I think, said in the previous talk, you should probably not treat yourself, or for example, with a depressive disease or something like that. And people are there who are taught in that specific field, and there should be a certain amount of trust, that's for sure. But it could lead to problems.
Well, you may need to distinguish between some kind of emergency support, where they say, oh yeah, I'm allergic to something. That's so important. You have to have your tag. Have it in your wallet or whatever else, painted on your breast. It doesn't matter. And things like your complete genome, where only experts can do anything with it, aside from Google just collecting it and storing it forever, and you won't get it anyhow back out of the system. And so you really need to distinguish in between those things.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I also think, it basically also boils down to which decisions are you willing to make for yourself. And with medical data, for example, one extreme case that I can come up with is Jehovah's Witnesses. They don't want a blood transfusion, and they refuse to do that, and it's in their wallet, and that's basically their medical decision. And if they are in an accident where they need a blood transfusion, then, well, if the doctor respects that, then the poor guy or girl or whatever will die, and you can make these decisions. The problem is that, especially in the Jehovah's Witness case, an informed decision, right? I'm not too sure about that.
Yes, it is. Also, the guy have a tool, don't resuscitate. Well, it's his decision.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what we wanted also to emphasize with that talk is that this concerns every one of us. So this is data about yourself, obviously, right? All the medical data and X-ray images, it's not just something, but this is very specifically yours, and that maybe we should think about making decisions about these kind of data, and also maybe educating ourselves in what can we decide, what can't we decide, how does the medical system need to adopt it to actually treat this data in a good way. Because at the moment, at least my gut feeling is, it's not. I mean, if I look at the medical databases at my doctor, it just gets me creeps, right? I run through four kinds of Windows errors, and then at some point it opens my X-ray, and I'm just, okay. hopefully he knows what he's looking at right now, because beforehand he clearly did not. Yeah, exactly. All these things, it's, yeah. Yeah. Well, at least it helped, so.
Just one or two things about personal autonomy. That's personal autonomy is a concept that's highly valued in our society. If I make this decision, okay, I don't want any blood transfusion, that might be that this decision is not very well clever in the sort of way that I'm likely to survive a car crash or something like that. Since you were talking about informed decisions, at least I'm willing to grant a person full autonomy on his decisions if the decision affects only him or her. So that's not a problem if the Jehovah's Witness says, okay, basically, an event of a blood transfusion, I don't want any, so I accept the risk that I'm going to die, then I think I'm strongly motivated to respect that decision.
Me too.
If he's trying to enforce this decision in a way that it affects other people, then obviously he can't make that decision. But if he's just making for itself, I don't see a problem.
No, it's not a problem. It was more or less an example for you can make these decisions even if it affects your life, right? And but you brought up another interesting perspective, especially for genetic data. If I, for example, get myself genotyped, this gives you information about the disease risks of your parents, and they might not ask for them, right? And this is
a decision that doesn't affect solely you.
Exactly.
You should inform your relatives that at least like the nearest ones that you're getting your genome tested because there is information in there about them.
True.
It's a decision that doesn't only affect you. It affects your relatives, obviously, your parents most directly, but siblings and other.
Yeah.
And if you decide to get that data, then this data exists, so you can't take it out of the world or something like that. You probably should be thinking about that beforehand.
Yeah. So I think to sum that up, I think our time is almost over. Thank you very much for the interesting discussion. Was a lot of fun. And well, if you have any questions, you can always approach Bastian and me. We're still around, or Bastian is easy to find on the internet. So.